Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A reminder about why Greece matters. Solving the farm worker shortage in Georgia, and a report from the beaches at Waikiki. They may not be there forever, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill, working with customers around the world to connect ideas to opportunities across food, agriculture, finance, and industry. Information at Cargill.com. And by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at MassMutual.com/mutuality.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday today, the 16th of June. Good to have you with us. And here's an investing tip for those with a risk tolerance that's on the high side. That'd be the very high side. You can buy a 2-year Greek government bond today and get a 29% yield. 29%. Of course, that assumes the Greek economy is going to be around in another 2 years to pay you off. The political and economic convulsions over the country's debt crisis continued again today. And this is one of those stories that's been around so long that it's tough to remember why it matters. So we asked Marketplace's Stephen Beard for a little what if, a hypothetical, how bad could it really get anyway?
Fear grips financial markets, dealers spooked by their worst nightmare. Memories of the collapse of Lehman Brothers haunt the trading desks. Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and Spain, between them, borrowed more than $3 trillion, much of it from European banks. If Greece defaults, maybe the others will too. Peter Tal Larson of Breaking Views.
You have potentially a vicious spiral that affects the confidence of the banking system. With defaults and losses then kind of spiraling one on top of the other. And that is really where the analogy is with Lehman.
By the middle of July, without another bailout, Greece will run out of cash. And that, says Tim Loinig of the London School of Economics, is when the European nightmare could begin to unfold.
Businesses find credit dries up, consumers can't get mortgages. It could be very painful indeed.
On a scale of 1 to 10, what are we talking about?
Oh, at least 12.
And don't think Americans will be able to enjoy watching this horror movie from a safe distance across the pond. In our globalized world, all the big banks are connected. Economist Andrew Hilton.
American banks will find their capital under pressure as well, and they will have to cut back on their lending. So generally across the world, there will be a contraction of credit.
But there is a more benign scenario. A happier ending. In the real world, says Tim Loinig, a fairy godmother will emerge, and between now and the middle of July, bail out the Greeks again.
Oh, I'm sure what will happen is that Europe will muddle through again. So the Germans in particular, but also the French, will come up with another package for Greece.
But there is an unsettling thought that maybe the Europeans will simply postpone the nightmare. An official at the IMF recently installed a jarring ringtone on his cell phone. The sound of a can being kicked down the road. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
So long as we're talking about government spending and cans being kicked down the road, here's something. Infrastructure. We need it. Repairs to what's there. New stuff as well. So it's good news that no punches were thrown at a meeting between hedge fund managers and treasury officials meeting to talk about a national infrastructure bank. A lot of people say spending on big projects like that is a key to economic growth. The challenge being how to bring private capital to big public works when there's no extra government money to be had. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
As an advisor to New York's retirement funds, Joyce Miller saw the pitfalls of trying to invest pension money in public works. Government and finance didn't always mix.
The two worlds not only don't speak to each other or communicate well, but they don't even begin to use the same vocabulary.
But now they're trying to speak the same language. Miller joined fellow bankers, hedge funds, and pension funds at a meeting with Treasury officials. They discussed how Wall Street can help the government launch a national infrastructure bank. It's the first time such a diverse group of financiers shared their opinions with the Obama administration about the proposed bank. The idea is to get Wall Street to lend money side by side with the government for big public projects.
There's a growing group of investors that wants to get involved in financing the building of new things, new roads, new bridges, new power plants, new wind farms.
That was Michael Lukowski. He teaches at NYU and helped organize the meeting. Wall Street has tried to invest in public works before, but it's always run into difficulties when politics interfered. Projects didn't get approved. The money lay idle.
If you rush ahead and let the politics solve itself later, then the deals fall apart.
There's a lot of broken infrastructure in America that could use help. At least one Wall Street banker at yesterday's meeting says what he wants to see is not more financing for the projects, but someone to approve them. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said today the White House has sent Congress all the justification for operations in Libya that it's going to send. That's not sitting well with some GOP members of the House, but there is a certain element of what you can do about it anyway to this most recent discussion of the War Powers Act. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has the story.
Speaker of the House John Boehner rejects the White House argument that Libyan airstrikes aren't covered by the War Powers Act. The 1973 law requires a president to get congressional permission for military actions after 60 days. Boehner is threatening to cut off funding for Libyan operations, but the president says he has no plans to ask for any more than the $1.1 billion he needs this year. James Lindsay at the Council on Foreign Relations says without a budget request, Congress is left with few options.
The only way Congress can stop the president is by passing a law demanding that he halt, in which case the president can veto the bill and Congress faces the very substantial challenge of trying to overturn a presidential veto.
10 House members have taken the other route available to them. They filed a lawsuit arguing the president circumvented Congress by not asking for War Powers Act permission in Libya. But by the time that case reaches the Supreme Court, Libya's civil war will likely be long over. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Up the eastern seaboard on Wall Street today, yesterday's Athens-induced swoon was just a distant memory. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So long as you learn from your mistakes, it's okay, right? That's what people say, isn't it? Commentator Rob Walker says, baloney.
The other day I read an interview with an entrepreneur who was not only bragging about his successes, he was bragging about his failures. Specifically, he was talking up the virtues of fast failure. This means quickly deducing that a new venture won't work, then you absorb those lessons and, of course, move on to do the next thing. Apparently, this is the best kind of failure. If you can't do it, then you're failing at failure itself. The good news, if you're looking to brush up on your failure skills, is that not succeeding is a hot topic these days. The Harvard Business Review recently devoted an issue to failure, and various other magazines, books, and even a batch of online videos featuring celebrated advertising and design stars make various cases for successful failure. Fail faster, fail smarter, fail often to succeed sooner, fail forward, and so on. At the heart of this failure chic is the argument that all your business and creative heroes experienced failure on the road to innovation. That's true, although so did all the cranks you've never heard of on the road to even more failure and total obscurity. Much of failure's recent trendiness can be chalked up to the familiar need to believe in marketplace rationality. A flop simply must be the result of some correctable misstep, as opposed to chance or someone else's mistakes or any other factor beyond our control. But consider the failure of Moby Dick. The only lesson in that for Herman Melville boils down to everybody else was wrong. Unfortunately for him, this insight came many decades after his death. Of course there are times when we learn from failure and that leads to innovation. But to frame failure as practically an accomplishment is to forget that all those business and creative heroes ultimately learned how to avoid it, overcome it, and most of all, defy it against all odds. Even that entrepreneur I was reading about must know this is so. Despite his enthusiasm for fast failure, it was a different idea that topped the list of reasons he offered for his success. Perseverance.
Rob Walker is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Send us your comments. Marketplace.org is our website. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. We'll be right back. There's a G20 economic meeting in Paris this coming Monday. No finance ministers, though, or central bankers. It's agriculture ministers this time, and how to keep rising global food prices at least a little bit under control. A lot of poor countries subsidize everyday items. This month, the government of Mozambique in southern Africa is going to stop helping out with food and gas costs. Those are subsidies that have been in place for 20 years, as Gretchen Wilson reports.
Mozambique is a coastal nation bigger than Texas, with about as many people. But most of those people live on less than $2 a day. The country's still recovering from a brutal civil war. So when global food prices skyrocketed a few years ago, the government chipped in just so people could eat.
It's about how do we ensure people have access to food.
Catherine Grant is with the South African Institute of International Affairs. She says Mozambique has to import two-thirds of its food. That's expensive. So for years, the government set artificially low prices on things like bread and paid the difference up to the true market price.
So it's a big cost on a government. It's a big benefit for consumers.
World Bank and IMF economists don't like these subsidies. Once they're in place, they're really tough to take away. In fact, Mozambique's government tried to cut its food subsidies last September. That pushed up the cost of bread more than 20%. Here's what happened. For 3 days, residents in the capital, Maputo, burnt tires in the streets and looted shops. Police opened fire. The riots left more than a dozen people dead and 600 injured. The government reinstated the subsidies just to end the unrest. But how does a poor government keep this up? As global food prices continue to rise, what's happening in Mozambique illustrates a larger story of developing countries trying to find a balance between fiscal responsibility and keeping citizens fed.
Really, the food subsidies are targeted towards urban consumers, a minority of the population, but a more politically influential subset of the population.
In other words, governments use subsidies to appeal to the urban poor, whose protests can shut down a city. In Mozambique, many people live in rural areas and eat food they grow themselves. The government's food subsidies don't help them because, effectively, they don't even live in a cash economy.
So these food subsidy programs really arise from political motivations rather than economic motivations, you know, rather than motivations to help the poorest of the poor in the country.
Yang says the rural majority would benefit more from subsidized fertilizer, but that wouldn't stop unrest. This month, Mozambique is again cutting its food subsidies, but some poor families will still be able to buy food baskets with bread, beans, and tinned fish at lower-than-market prices. No one knows if that will be enough to prevent new riots in Mozambique or if the country will remain a tinderbox. Lyle White is a political economist at Gibbs, the business school of the University of Pretoria.
Food security is definitely one of those catalysts that can ignite a nation, especially here in southern Africa. It can literally change overnight. Riots and protests in the streets of Mozambique could trigger off something far more drastic.
That should give Mozambique's government food for thought. The other countries where food subsidies have been deeply entrenched are places like Egypt, Bahrain, and Libya. In Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Coming up, the climate change downside of an oceanfront view.
In some cases, the sea level might be in your living room, you know, in the next 50 or 100 years.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 64 points today, about 0.5%, settled at 11,961, the blue chips did. The S&P 500 edged up 2 points, around 0.2%, wrapped things at 1,267. But the NASDAQ, it slid 7 points, almost 0.3%, ended at 2,623. New home construction picked up steam last month. Good news for home builders Lennar and KB Home. Their stock each nailed gains of about 2%, rivals D.R. Horton and Pulte Homes, tacked on 1.5% apiece. Meantime, shares of Home Depot improved more than 1.75%. Shares of Kroger rang up 4.5% today after the nation's biggest grocery store chain reported better-than-expected earnings. People got to eat, I guess, is the line. Higher food and gas costs are helping pad their bottom line. Rivals Walmart and Costco rode Kroger's coattails today, added about 1% apiece. Debt drama in Greece continued to roil markets overseas. The British FTSE lost 0.75%. The French CAC 40 was off about 0.33%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's Magazine, providing market ideas and insights to help readers manage their investments and protect their financial well-being, online at barrons.com. And by Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted mail, Reputation.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2011 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at jaguarusa.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. Leading up to the longest day of the year, residents in Nome, Alaska celebrate 22 hours of direct sunlight with the Midnight Sun Festival. And Barry Manilow celebrates his 68th birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The state of Georgia's got a tough new immigration law about to go into effect, and it's making life harder for farmers in the Peach State. A survey not too long ago found they're short about 11,000 workers, jobs most commonly filled by immigrants, both legal and not. The news has brought an interesting proposal from Georgia Governor Nathan Deal. How about filling those jobs, the governor said, with people on probation who are looking for work? Charles Hall is the executive director of the Georgia Fruit and Vegetable Growers Association. It is an industry trade group. Mr. Hall, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Guy.
Where did this idea come from of having probationers work in the farms?
I think it was a brainstorming session with several of our commissioners and I guess with the governor. I'm not sure where it came from.
Now, to be clear, this would be a voluntary program, right? Because I have to tell you, when I first heard about it, it sounded vaguely like a chain gang.
And a probationary person that is on probation would be hired by the farm just like a regular citizen would be hired. There's not something that would be mandatory. Of course, they have to be able to withstand the work performance level. It's hot in Georgia. Right now it's about 98 degrees outside, and this is a 8 to 10 hour job that you're out in the field. You're stooping, bending, lifting, and it's not something that, everybody can do.
How much are they going to make?
The average harvester in Georgia, depending, again, on the commodity, but our average harvester makes somewhere around $12.50 an hour. It all depends on productivity because the harvesters are paid based on piece rate, but they have to be paid at least the minimum wage.
Now, Georgia has a new immigration law, which is fairly strict in who can work in that state. How much of a role do you think that law had in migrant labor staying away from the state of Georgia?
Well, we understand from talking to our crew leaders and their conversations with the immigrant workers that many of them felt concerned as to what the new law would mean for them. How well would they be able to move around the state, if they were stopped for a traffic violation, if they did not have the proper documentation on them, whether they would be deported at that time.
Yeah. Was your group in favor of or opposed to that law?
We were opposed to the law. This is House Bill 87. We were concerned about the law for several reasons, but primarily because of concerns that how the additional burden it puts on the growers as far as the E-Verify portion of the law. Mm-hmm. There was concerns with regard to the enforcement component of the law, but we quite honestly didn't expect the reaction to the enforcement component of the law to be quite as strong as what it's been.
Charles Hall, he's the executive director of the Georgia Fruit and Vegetable Growers Association. Mr. Hall, thanks so much for your time.
Glad to.
Moscow is about this close to signing a trillion-dollar natural gas deal with China. It would be by far the biggest investment Russia's gotten in a good long while. The Kremlin is actively seeking out new businesses. In fact, that's why they've invited executives and government officials from across the world to St. Petersburg for a three-day international economic forum. If that sounds a lot like the World Economic Forum in Davos, yeah, that's intentional. Peter Van Dyke has the story.
Many of the sleek black Mercedes ferrying VIPs around St. Petersburg have Moscow license plates, and certainly anyone who's anyone in Russian business has left the modern capital for the ancient one today. But the really important visitors are here from abroad. Russia uses the forum to sell itself to foreign investors. Roland Nash of Verno Capital in Moscow is attending for the fourth time.
They certainly get a lot of people coming every year. So in that sense, they're achieving their objective. Where they are less successful is actually getting people to invest as a result of it.
The foreigners who do invest can reap big rewards, says Hans-Paul Berkner, head of the Boston Consulting Group.
Major companies from the U.S. have done extremely well because they have been very persistent and not let themselves be deterred from some of the issues that clearly are there.
Those companies include PepsiCo, Caterpillar and Boeing. Those issues are corruption, the rule of law and investor protections. They come up time and time again in discussions between Washington and Moscow. Lorraine Harriton is the State Department's special representative for commercial and business affairs.
I think the more that they can work on getting the business environment and the rule of law in a way that makes people feel comfortable, I think that will really facilitate more business between the two countries.
Certainly, the St. Petersburg Forum gets global attention and good PR, but people who do business here know Russia still has work to do if it is to get to the level of investment it wants. In St. Petersburg, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
The planet's getting warmer. That much isn't really in doubt. But come on, we've got debt crises all over the place, unemployment up to here, and a housing market still not going anywhere. So something like climate change that won't really bite us for, what, another 20 or 30 years. How much does it matter right now? It depends on where you live. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk and the Aloha State, Adrienne Hill reports.
Some of Hawaii's beaches are pristine. White sand, blue waves, space to contemplate the beauty of the world and relax. Ah. Oh yeah, sorry. And then there are other beaches, a little less idyllic. Take Waikiki. Tourists in sarongs and leis, reeking of coconut-scented sunscreen, all jammed together. A couple sitting too close to the water scrambles from a wave. The beach is washing away.
Waikiki is suffering erosion, and there is a lot of concern on how to manage this problem.
Chip Fletcher teaches oceanography and earth science at the University of Hawaii. The sea is rising here, and with it, Hawaii's beaches are eroding, 70% of them chronically. Sea level has been rising in Hawaii at a fairly steady rate for the last century, and Fletcher expects to see that rate accelerate in the near future as the effects of climate change kick in. He's drawing up models for what a meter of sea level rise in the next century would look like.
This problem of managing erosion, eroding beaches, is going to become more difficult and presumably more expensive. So simplistically, if we are renourishing Waikiki Beach, say, every 5 or 10 years, that schedule has to accelerate if we want to continue to maintain a beach there.
It'll cost millions to keep Waikiki sandy. The state's going to pay for some of it. Hotels are chipping in, too. They have to dredge sand from offshore and dump it on the beach. But letting Waikiki disappear would be disaster for Hawaii's economy.
Tourism for Hawaii is our number one industry, and it's our biggest economic factor here. It's critical to the well-being of the future for all of Hawaii.
Robbie Connie is with the State Tourism Board. She says the office commissioned a study on the economic impact of letting the beach at Waikiki disappear.
The estimates from that study talked about losing nearly $2 billion in revenues every year and losing over 6,000 jobs if we didn't have Sandy Beach in Waikiki.
But not every beach is as important as Waikiki, and the state has limited funding.
We need to look at some priorities. I look at it as triage. What beaches can we save for the next generation, and what beaches are going to be difficult to save?
Sam Limo heads the State Office of Conservation and Coastal Lands. He says it's important for people to start thinking about these things now, building away from the erosion zone, planning better for the wetter future, understanding what sea level rise might mean both to the economy and to them. His office has created sea level projection plans for some individual communities and homeowners.
Because in some cases, the sea level might be in your living room, you know, in the next 50 or 100 years. And we show that in maps.
Limo says it seems like more people are listening and paying attention now. They're starting to believe in climate change and sea level rise. But the knowledge doesn't make the answers any easier.
This is their life. This is their thing they're going to leave to their children. This is their heritage. And you're telling them that, you know, it's going to be underwater effectively in 100 years. You know, I can't even describe, you know, all of the complex thoughts that might go through somebody's mind regarding that problem.
Unfortunately, it's a problem that's just beginning. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. By FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, wherein reports of a tech bubble may turn out to have been greatly exaggerated. You remember yesterday's big IPO, Pandora, the streaming music service? Shares had a nice little bump at the open yesterday, then closed just about where they started. They should be so lucky today. Investors apparently realized the company has never made any money. Shares down 23%. They are now almost $3 underwater from their offering price yesterday. And on that note, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Markets were mixed today. The Dow added 64 points, about a half percent, 11,961 at the bell. The S&P 500 edged up 2 points, around 0.2%, 1267. The NASDAQ slid 7 points, almost a third of 1%, 2623, the number you're looking for. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time, back here, a good walk, spoil.
Somewhere between number 1 and number 18, you find time to bring up what you need to bring up, and it works.
Doing deals between chip shots. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.